He was born in the hills of Jamaica, raised in the heart of a concrete jungle, and rose to become the voice of the voiceless. Bob Marley didn't just make music. He sparked revolutions, calmed civil wars, and preached unity to a world divided. From the ghettos of Kingston to the battlefields of apartheid South Africa, his songs became weapons of peace, prayers of resistance, and anthems of freedom. This is not just the story of a man. It's the story of a global awakening, told through rhythm, rebellion, and redemption. The gospel, according to Bob Marley, still sings. And the echo? It never ends. Welcome to the History of the Caribbean's podcast. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today, we present to you Bob Marley, A Journey Through Time, Episode 3. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 9, Redemption Song. There are songs that move people. There are songs that unite people. And then there are songs that transcend people altogether. Songs that live long after the singer, that feel less like compositions and more like sacred transmissions from a higher place. For Bob Marley, that song was Redemption Song. It was not recorded with a full band. There were no thick bass lines, no steady skank of the rhythm guitar, no percussion to lift the tempo. Just Bob, a steel string acoustic guitar, and truth. But before the song could be born, Bob had to walk deeper into the valley of the shadow of death. By 1980, he was living with the knowledge that his body was failing. The melanoma that had first appeared years earlier in his toe had now crept like a thief into the corners of his being. His lungs, liver, brain, his muscles weakened, his weight dropped. He suffered from dizzy spells, tremors, fatigue. And yet, even as death sat with him, he kept creating. He had always believed his life was not truly his own. "Me is not me," he once said. "Me is the people." So even as his body gave way, Bob kept writing. He didn't know how much time he had, but he understood that the words would live beyond him, that in the stillness of a song, he could send his soul into eternity. In a quiet moment, some say it was in Miami, others say it was in London, Bob sat with his guitar and began to play. The chords were simple: E minor, G, C, D. But in that simplicity, there was weight. There was prophecy. The lyrics flowed not as performance, but as confession, as closure, as farewell. "Old pirates, yes they rob I, sold I to the merchant ships, minutes after they took I, from the bottomless pit." These were not just verses, they were the story of the African diaspora, the scars of slavery, the theft of identity, the wounds passed down through generations. Bob was singing for every chained ancestor, for every stolen name, for every silenced voice. He was stitching centuries of pain into a melody barely over 3 minutes long. But then came the turn. "But my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty." Here was the resistance, the rising, the refusal to be erased. And finally, the heart of the song: "Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds." That line wasn't born from poetry class. It was lifted in spirit from a speech by Marcus Garvey, the Black nationalist and Pan-Africanist, whose teachings had shaped Bob's worldview. But Bob didn't quote Garvey as dogma. He breathed it into a whisper of revolution. No screaming, no slogans, just a quiet, unwavering call for mental freedom, the final and hardest frontier. He sang it not just to the oppressed, but to the oppressors, to the indifferent, to the blind, to himself. "Have no fear for atomic energy, 'cause none of them can stop the time." The world was teetering on the edge of Cold War paranoia. Nuclear weapons, political assassinations, corruption in every corner. But Bob knew that power, real power, was in the spirit. And once awakened, no bomb could kill it. Redemption Song was not just Bob Marley's greatest song. It was his will, his spiritual will, his political will, his poetic will. He knew he would not live to see the full harvest of what he had planted. But in this song, he sealed the seed. When Bob recorded Redemption Song for the 1980 album Uprising, he insisted on keeping it bare. No overdubs, no band, no embellishment, just the essence. Some band members were surprised. The Wailers were known for lush grooves, for thunderous roots reggae. This was a skeleton, a prayer. But Bob knew what he was doing. The stripped sound left nothing to hide behind. It was just the man and the message. And when the album dropped, Redemption Song stood alone, quiet, haunting, unmatched. Even listeners who didn't know the full scope of Marley's illness could feel it. That this wasn't just music. This was a goodbye. He performed the song in concerts during that final tour, sometimes seated, sometimes with his eyes closed. Audiences went silent. No lighters, no cheers. Just awe, reverence. The kind of stillness usually reserved for funerals or births. Because that's what it was. A birth through death. In private, Bob began preparing himself. Not as a man defeated, but as a warrior finishing his mission. He spoke more with his children. He meditated deeper. He accepted, even embraced, what was coming. There are accounts from friends and family of Bob becoming more luminous, more serene in those final months, like someone who had seen beyond the veil. "Me don't fear death," he said once calmly. "Me only fear that jaw work no get done." In between treatment in Germany, he continued to write in journals, to read scripture, to speak of Africa. He worried more about his people, Jamaica, Ethiopia, the ghetto youth, than he did about himself. And Redemption Song became his shield, his torch, his last sermon. He didn't want pity. He wanted people to think, to awaken, to act. Because to Bob Marley, redemption wasn't about salvation in the next life. It was about liberation in this one. As the cancer advanced, Bob made one final attempt to reach home. He boarded a flight from Germany to Jamaica, but his condition worsened mid-flight. He was rerouted to Miami, where he was taken to Cedars of Lebanon Hospital. There, surrounded by family, he slipped into a coma. On May 11, 1981, Bob Marley died at the age of 36. His final words to his son Ziggy were simple. "Money can't buy life." A whisper of truth. A man who had been rich in love, poor in rest, and eternally rich in purpose. But Bob didn't die that day. Not really. He lived on in every verse of Redemption Song, which continues to be sung by presidents, prisoners, protesters, and poets. It's covered by artists from every genre. It's quoted on walls and wept over in silence. It's become a hymn for the human spirit. Because in the end, Bob Marley didn't leave us with instructions. He left us with a song. And that song asks a question we must each answer. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? Chapter 10, The Lion Fades, The Legacy Grows. There's a hush that follows the roar, a silence that doesn't signal surrender, but a shift, a sacred transition from what is loud and alive to what is eternal and unseen. For Bob Marley, the lion's roar had been echoing across continents, radio waves, ghettos, and palaces for over a decade. But by the spring of 1981, his voice, once so unshakable, so defiant, so drenched in truth, had begun to quiet, not in spirit, but in flesh. His body, that once darted across stages with hypnotic rhythm, now struggled to rise from bed. His legs, once sprinting across football fields with barefoot grace, now trembled under the weight of every step. His once glowing skin had turned pale from the treatments. His dreadlocks, his crown, had thinned and faded. And though the light in his eyes still flickered, it was no longer fire. It was sunset. Bob Marley had fought a quiet war for 4 long years. From the moment the melanoma was discovered in his toe in 1977, he had lived under the shadow of a sentence he refused to accept. He sought every path, herbal remedies, homeopathy, Rasta healing rituals, fasting, medical treatment in Germany under controversial Dr. Joseph Issels, whose clinic specialized in non-traditional cancer therapies. Bob endured painful detoxes, restrictive diets, immune-boosting regimens, and rigorous natural therapies. He did it not for vanity, nor for fear, but for his mission. He had music left to record, children left to teach, people left to reach. He wanted to squeeze every last drop of time out of this borrowed body because he understood one truth that few men ever do. His life was not his own. But even prophets must rest. And in early May of 1981, Bob knew. He knew the time had come to return home. Bob attempted the journey from Bavaria to Kingston, but his condition rapidly deteriorated mid-flight. As the jet soared over the Atlantic, his vital signs began to crash. His family, who had grown accustomed to moments of strength amidst weakness, now saw something different in his eyes. Peace. Not defeat, not despair, just a quiet, almost reverent surrender. He didn't cry. He didn't cling. He had always said death was not the enemy, only disconnection from purpose. Unable to complete the journey, the plane made an emergency landing in Miami, Florida. Bob was rushed to Cedars of Lebanon Hospital, now known as University of Miami Hospital. He was placed in intensive care. Machines buzzed, for lines ran through his arms. Monitors blinked like artificial stars in a sterile sky. But none of it felt real. The man who had once stood on stages in Zimbabwe and United Tribes, who had faced assassins and stood back up, who had held Manly and Sega's hands in his, was now laying motionless beneath fluorescent lights, tethered to tubes and wires. His family gathered, Rita, Ziggy, Stephen, Sadella, Sharon, his mother Sadella Malcolm, and others. They came in silence. They did not wail. They stood like sentinels, as if guarding the last moments of a saint. Nurses moved quietly. Doctors whispered. In those final hours, Bob drifted in and out of consciousness. Some say he hummed softly. Others say he tried to speak. What is certain is that his last words, whispered to Ziggy, were simple and shattering. Money can't buy life. A final teaching. A final truth. And then, just after dawn, on May 11, 1981, at 11:45 a.m., Robert Nesta Marley exhaled for the last time. He was 36 years old. And just like that, the lion faded. But the roar had only just begun to echo. The news swept through the world, like wind through cane fields. Jamaica mourned like it had lost a father. Flags were lowered. Streets fell silent. Even rival gang members laid down arms. In Kingston, people wept in the streets, holding each other, holding radios, playing his music through the static of cheap speakers and broken cassette decks. Mothers clutched their children. Rastas burned chalice in his honor. Elders sat and cried silently. The weight of the moment was not just grief, it was realization. They had not merely lost a musician. They had lost a liberator with a guitar. Across Africa, Bob's name was spoken like prayer. In Zimbabwe, where he had sung for independence, leaders declared him a brother of the soil. In Ethiopia, where the Rasta spirit pointed toward Zion, prayers were held. In London, New York, Paris, Berlin, his face appeared on newspapers, billboards, graffiti walls. The West, which had once feared or dismissed him, now canonized him. And then came the funeral. On May 21, 1981, 10 days after his death, Bob Marley was given a state funeral in Jamaica. It was a ceremony unlike anything the island or the world had ever seen. Part military, part Rastafari, part spiritual celebration. His coffin was draped with the Ethiopian flag and the Lion of Judah. Inside the casket, he wore a red, gold, and green Rasta garment. His Gibson Les Paul guitar placed beside him, along with a Bible and a stalk of ganja, symbols of the Holy Trinity in his life, truth, sound, and spirit. The funeral procession crawled through Kingston. Tens of thousands lined the streets, singing, crying, chanting. From the slums of Trench Town to the hills of Saint, and the people came. They didn't just watch, they walked, barefoot and heart first, behind the hearse, behind the beat of a man they had once called Tuff Gong. The service itself was held at the National Arena. World leaders, religious figures, musicians, and street prophets shared space in reverence. Speeches were made. Songs were sung. Rita, strong and composed, stood before the crowd and sang No Woman, No Cry, the song he had written for her during hard times. But this time, the meaning had changed. This time, the woman was the world. And the cry, uncontainable. Bob was laid to rest in Nine Mile, the place of his birth. A small village where red dirt still clings to the soles of bare feet, where the hills remember his first cry and now hold his final sleep. A marble mausoleum was built to honor him. Above it, a sign reads simply, the legend lives on. And indeed he did. In death, Bob Marley did what few ever do. He became larger, not smaller. More alive, not less. He crossed into that rare realm where flesh becomes folklore, where voice becomes gospel. His music surged in popularity. Albums like Legend, Uprising, and Exodus charted again. People who had never listened now played his songs on loop. School curriculums began to include his lyrics. Political speeches quoted him. Prisoners tattooed him. Artists sampled him. Nations claimed him. But no one could own him, because he belonged to the people. His children stepped forward, not in shadow, but in light. Ziggy, Stephen, Damian, Julian, Kaimani, and others would carry his sound forward, each in their own way, some staying close to reggae, others fusing hip-hop, rock, and soul, but all carrying his flame. Rita Marley, already a legend in her own right, became a guardian of the legacy, building the Bob Marley Foundation, preserving the museum at 56 Hope Road, supporting schools, medical clinics, and cultural programs around the world. The Marley name became not just a symbol of music, but a symbol of freedom, resistance, and global black consciousness. The lion had faded, but the jungle was now filled with echoes of his roar. You could hear it in the streets of Soweto, where youth faced apartheid with fists and Marley's lyrics. You could hear it in the refugee camps of Palestine, where a redemption song played on battered radios. You could hear it in inner-city classrooms where teachers, too poor to buy books, used Get Up, Stand Up as a lesson plan. You could hear it in silence, where once there had been despair, now there was hope. And that is how legends grow. Not in fame, but in the space they leave behind. A space filled by every child who dares to sing truth to power, by every soul who walks barefoot into injustice and speaks peace. The lion had faded, but the legacy was now roaring through the world. Chapter 11, Zion's Thunder After the Storm. When the storm passes, it does not leave silence. It leaves thunder. It leaves echoes. It leaves a sky that still vibrates with the roar of what has come and gone. When Bob Marley passed on May 11, 1981, the world did not grow quiet. It grew louder, not in sound, but in meaning. The storm that was Bob Marley, his music, his message, his mission, had broken over the world like a long-awaited cleansing rain. And when the rain stopped, the thunder began to roll, a deep rumble of awakening that stretched far beyond the shores of Jamaica. This was not just a posthumous appreciation. This was the activation of a global pulse. In the days immediately following his funeral, the island of Jamaica felt different. Streets that once rang with sirens now pulsed with speakers playing redemption song. Taxi drivers, who once argued over fares, now nodded silently to lyrics that felt heavier than ever. Grandmothers in market stalls quoted him. Children who had never seen him live spoke his name like it belonged in scripture. Bob wasn't gone. He had multiplied. His death marked the beginning of a new life, one lived through people who had once been voiceless, now echoing with his words. From the hills of Saint and to the alleyways of Trench Town, Bob Marley had become a frequency, and the whole world was tuning in. And it wasn't just in Jamaica. Thousands of miles away, in South Africa, his voice was already being smuggled past censors, played in secret among revolutionaries, freedom fighters, and students facing down the brutality of apartheid. At a time when Nelson Mandela was still locked behind prison bars, Bob Marley's music became a spiritual machete, cutting through the lies of the oppressor, slicing into the hearts of those who still believed freedom was possible. Songs like Get Up, Stand Up, and War were adopted by the anti-apartheid movement not as entertainment, but as weapons of defiance. Bob's lyrics, drawn from a 1963 speech by Haile Selassie, became a rallying cry, until the philosophy which holds one race superior and another inferior is finally and permanently discredited and abandoned everywhere is war. It wasn't metaphor anymore. It was prophecy. And in the townships of Soweto, in the political rallies of Harare, in the prisons of Robben Island, Bob Marley's voice thundered like a drumbeat of destiny. But Africa was not the only place where the storm echoed. In London, Paris, Amsterdam, and Berlin, Marley's name became synonymous with rebellion. street artists painted his image on walls beside clenched fists. Activists quoted his lyrics in speeches. Teachers brought his words into classrooms, using them to teach not only language, but justice. In the United States, his music was absorbed into the pulse of the civil rights movement, especially among black youth in Brooklyn, Chicago, and Oakland. The language of Rastafari, the talk of Babylon, Zion, and I, became the poetry of resistance in inner cities, in spoken word poetry slams, and in graffiti scrawled across subway tunnels. Hip-hop artists, many of whom came from the same streets Marley sang about, began citing him as a spiritual predecessor. Though he never rapped, Bob's cadence, conviction, and street wisdom made him a kind of proto-MC, an elder whose truth laid the groundwork for the bars to come. By the mid-1980s, Bob Marley's Legend compilation album, released in 1984, began to soar across the world. It wasn't just a hit, it was a phenomenon. In a world saturated with fast pop and empty hooks, Marley's voice cut through like a blade wrapped in silk. The album included songs from various stages of his career, but together they told a single unified story. A story of struggle, awakening, redemption, and resistance. No Woman, No Cry, Three Little Birds, One Love, Buffalo Soldier, Could You Be Loved, they weren't just songs anymore. They were hymns, each with a rhythm, a lesson, a wound, and a bomb. Legend became one of the best-selling albums of all time. To this day, it is the highest-selling reggae album in history, with over 25 million copies sold worldwide. But more importantly, it turned Bob Marley into a global ancestor. As the 1980s gave way to the 1990s, and then to the 2000s, Marley's voice only grew louder in absence. His image, lion-eyed, dreadlocked, immortal, became as iconic as Che Guevara's, as universally recognized as Mandela's, as misunderstood as Malcolm's. For some, he became a symbol of weed culture, a commercialized figure stamped on rolling papers and t-shirts. But for those who knew, for those who listened, Bob Marley was never about escapism. His use of ganja was sacramental, spiritual, revolutionary. "The herb is the healing of a nation," he once said. "Not a toy, a tool, not a party, a portal." And even as capitalism tried to repackage him, his words resisted commodification. They lived beyond the brand. They reached into the soul. In Jamaica, Marley became more than a memory. He became a national treasure. His former home at 56, Hope Road, was transformed into the Bob Marley Museum, a pilgrimage site where fans from across the globe came to walk through the rooms he once paced, touch the guitar strings he once drummed, and feel the vibration still lingering in the walls. In Nine Mile, where he was buried, his mausoleum became a holy site for Rastafari and Marley devotees alike. People came barefoot. People came weeping. People came laughing. But they all came for one reason: to be near the source. In 1990, Marley was posthumously awarded Jamaica's Order of Merit, the country's third highest honor. The government that once feared his influence now built monuments in his name. By 2001, 20 years after his death, he was posthumously awarded the Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award. That same year, Time magazine named Exodus the greatest album of the 20th century. Bob Marley had not just survived death, he had outlived it. But perhaps the most thunderous part of the storm he left behind was not in awards or memorials. It was in the ordinary people who now lived by his message. The mother in Nairobi who named her son Marley because his music helped her survive war. The refugee in Palestine who tattooed Redemption Song on his wrist. The protester in Ferguson who played Get Up, Stand Up through a bullhorn. The teacher in Sao Paulo who used Buffalo Soldier to explain colonialism. The child in Haiti who sang One Love under candlelight after a hurricane flattened his school. These people were not fans. They were echoes. Proof that Bob Marley did not merely entertain. He ignited. Zion's thunder is not loud like bombs or speeches. It is steady, low, unyielding. It rolls through the generations. It hides in headphones and loudspeakers and lullabies and revolutions. It does not shout. It summons. And the voice it carries most clearly still belongs to Bob Marley, the man who died young, but never grew old. Chapter 12, The House of Marley. The roots of a great tree do not die when the trunk falls. They press deeper into the soil. They send out new shoots. They rise again, not as one, but as many. When Bob Marley passed from this world in 1981, he did not vanish. He left behind a house, not made of walls, but of people, of children and mothers, of shared purpose and spiritual flame. He left behind a dynasty, not built on palaces or privilege, but on truth, rhythm, resilience, and revolution. This was not a house of marble. This was the house of Marley. Rita Marley, the matriarch of the mission. At the heart of the house stood a woman whose strength rivaled the legend himself. Alfreda Constantia Anderson, Rita Marley. She was not just Bob's wife. She was his backbone, his harmony, his soldier in song and in life. Rita had sung beside Bob for years as a member of the I3s, along with Judy Mowat and Marcia Griffiths, helping to craft the lush harmonies that elevated Bob's message into spiritual gospel. But after his death, Rita took on a new role, guardian of the flame. She became the steward of his estate, the protector of his music, and the voice that ensured that Bob Marley was not consumed by commercialization, but preserved as a prophet. Rita founded the Bob Marley Foundation, an organization dedicated to education, social justice, poverty alleviation, and the promotion of Rastafarian values. She invested in schools, helped fund housing projects, and offered scholarships for underserved youth, particularly in rural parts of Jamaica. But she did not just carry his legacy in programs. She carried it in people. The children, the new sound of legacy. Bob Marley fathered 11 acknowledged children, each unique in their own path, but all undeniably touched by the spirit of their father. Some of his children came from Rita. Others came from different women in Bob's life. And though the structure may defy traditional Western notions of family, in the Rastafari worldview, all the children were one family, under one son, held together by blood, music, and purpose. Let us walk through the branches of this growing tree. Ziggy Marley, the torchbearer. David Ziggy Marley, born to Bob and Rita in 1968, was just a teenager when his father passed. But the fire in him was already burning. Ziggy emerged in the 1980s as the frontman of Ziggy Marley and the Melody Makers, a band that included his siblings Steven, Sadella, and Sharon. Their debut album, Play the Game Right, echoed with Bob's wisdom, but also marked the beginning of Ziggy's voice, a mix of hope, awareness, and experimentation. Their 1988 album Conscious Party, produced by Tina Weymouth and Chris France of Talking Heads, catapulted the group into international fame and won the Grammy Award for Best Reggae Album. Ziggy's charisma, lyrical sharpness, and stage presence reminded audiences of his father, but he refused to become a carbon copy. He carved his own path, blending reggae, funk, pop, and soul, and eventually pursued a solo career that won him multiple Grammy Awards, not just in reggae, but also in children's music, a genre he saw as a way to raise conscious, joyful human beings. Ziggy became more than a musician. He became a public intellectual, a social activist, a humanitarian, speaking out on climate change, education, and justice. Steven Marley, the sound architect. Steven Marley, born in 1972, may be the most musically versatile of Bob's children. Known as Ragamuffin, Steven is a producer, singer, and multi-instrumentalist who helped shape the sound of many of his siblings' albums, especially Damien's breakthrough records. Steven has won 8 Grammy Awards, both for his solo work and collaborations. He blends roots reggae with hip-hop, R&B, dub, and sometimes even Afrobeat, creating layered soundscapes that feel both ancient and futuristic. He has produced albums for Lauryn Hill, Capleton, and Buju Banton, and is seen by many as the sonic keeper of his father's spirit, a master technician with the soul of a poet. Damien Marley, the rebel with global range. Perhaps the most internationally disruptive Marley is Damien Jr. Gong Marley, born to Bob and Cindy Breakspear, Miss World 1976. Damien entered the global spotlight with the release of Welcome to Jamrock in 2005, a raw, uncompromising anthem that exposed Jamaica's political corruption and urban poverty. The track went platinum and earned 2 Grammy Awards, cementing Damien's place not just in reggae, but in global hip-hop. He collaborated with Nas on the 2010 album Distant Relatives, a Pan-African diasporic project that fused ancient rhythms with modern rebellion. The album tackled themes of repatriation, ancestral memory, identity, and global black unity. Damian is a bridge between Kingston and Brooklyn, between tradition and technology, between history and prophecy. Julian Kaimani and the Extended House. Julian Marley, born in London, carries the conscious lyricism of his father and has released several critically praised albums, including Awake, which was nominated for a Grammy. He is known for his deeply spiritual performances and commitment to clean living and natural healing. Kaimani Marley, son of Bob and Anita Belnavis, emerged with a grittier, more urban sound, blending reggae with hip-hop and dancehall. His album The Journey was a commercial success and spoke to inner-city struggles and emotional resilience. Each Marley child has, in their own way, carried a piece of their father's soul forward, not as mimicry, but as evolution. The Marley brand, from roots to reach. The House of Marley is not only a musical legacy. It has also become a global movement, extending into environmentalism, entrepreneurship, and cultural preservation. The family launched the House of Marley, a line of eco-conscious audio products, headphones, speakers, and turntables made from sustainable materials like bamboo, recyclable aluminum, and reclaimed wood. The brand isn't just selling sound. It's selling values, conscious consumption, environmental responsibility, and sound as healing. Through Marley Natural, the family entered the legal cannabis space, not just as business people, but as advocates for decriminalization, justice for nonviolent offenders, and respect for the spiritual use of the herb. The Marley family has made it clear, this legacy is not nostalgia. It is revolution in motion, philanthropy, activism, and the eternal message. The Bob Marley Foundation continues to impact lives across the Caribbean and the diaspora. Its mission, live for yourself and you will live in vain. Live for others and you will live again, guides initiatives in education, culture, human rights, and health. From mobile dental clinics in rural Jamaica, to scholarship programs for ghetto youth, to support for Haitian earthquake victims, the Marleys remain rooted in service. In 2010, Rita Marley announced plans to repatriate Bob's remains to Ethiopia, fulfilling his lifelong spiritual longing to be buried in Zion. The plan sparked public debate and remains unresolved, but it reveals just how alive Bob's presence remains, how every decision about him still ripples with spiritual weight. A living house, a breathing legacy. The House of Marley is not a museum. It is a living, breathing force. It is the teenager in Lagos who sings One Drop in front of a crowd. It is the mother in Soweto who hums No Woman, No Cry while preparing dinner over open flame. It is the protester in Sao Paulo who carries a Bob Marley flag at a march for indigenous land rights. It is the American college student who first hears Redemption Song and changes majors from economics to social justice. It is every barefoot child who dances without shame. Every dreadlocked elder who reasons by candlelight. Every soul who dares to sing truth in a world that profits from silence. That is the House of Marley, built on rhythm, fortified by resistance, powered by love, and always, always echoing with the sound of revolution.